I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, our ethical obligation to animals, the ones we eat, the ones out in the wild, the ones who work for us, and the ones who share our homes. We'll spend this hour with law professor David S. Favor, who says we often fail to make any decisions about the respectful use of animals, defaulting instead to just doing what's been done before. Favor's new book challenges us to pause and consider how animals are part of our communities and our ecosystem, and to think deeply about what we accept as normal in order to avoid causing them unjustifiable suffering. Our conversation starts after this short break. Relationship to animals is complicated. What exactly do we owe them, and on what grounds? Should it matter what they can do for us? And do we ever have the right to cause them suffering because it is good for us? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The animal abolitionism movement argues that all use of all animals by humans is wrong. Eating them, giving them jobs, pulling wagons, or guiding people with disabilities, even owning them as pets. At the other end of the spectrum are people who believe that as the dominant species on the planet, humans have a right to use animals however they choose. The middle ground is more challenging to parse, and it will require thinking deeply about whatever assumptions we hold and making careful ethical choices. David S. Favor is professor of law at Michigan State University School of Law. His new book is called Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So you advocate something you call the respectful use of animals as a kind of middle path between complete disregard for their welfare and the belief that we have the right to do whatever we want to them and with them. What do you mean by respectful use?
Well, that means that we acknowledge their existence, that we acknowledge that they have lives, individual lives, and they have individual needs and desires. And as other living beings on the planet, we ought to respect that by acknowledging it and trying to, when we interact with them, to help them have a good life.
What evidence do you have that most of us haven't thought very deeply about the way we relate to animals?
Well, it's conversations over a lifetime with people. When we talk about, have you thought about what the cattle in the field are facing, or, you know, how do you think about chimpanzees and things like that? It's very often clear to me that they've not thought about it very deeply, that they have sort of a TV level response to most issues.
A lot of religions offer guidelines about how humans should use animals. Setting aside the fact that not everyone follows a religion, why are religious teachings not sufficient to dictate how we might treat animals?
That's a very good question, and I don't have a full answer to that one, because on a global basis, there are a number of religions that, and animals are a significant part of some of those religions. But the way animals get treated in reality does not seem to vary all that much from country to country. It seems human nature takes a particular position about the dominance of the human species and accepts that dominance over animals, notwithstanding any religious views.
This book made me think a lot about the hierarchy that we create for different animals based on our needs and desires. Yeah. Why are we comfortable, David, with maybe contributing money to save endangered elephants, and yet we're eager to eradicate mosquitoes?
Well, I might actually support both of those views. But it comes about because the human mind puts things in boxes. And so we talk about elephants, and that's in a particular box of iconic species, beautiful animals, intelligent animals, and that's one box. And mosquitoes are in a box called pest, and we can kill pests. There's no question about that.
Okay, well, sometimes animals might go in a different box in different settings. So let's say we have the same species of rat. One lives in a forest, one's in a city sewer, one is a pet in a 12-year-old's tank somewhere, one is a lab animal. What do we need to think about as we consider why they deserve radically different treatment from us?
Well, that is one of the more difficult questions. And I think my approach has been to acknowledge that all those different aspects that you just described come out of being in different communities, human-animal communities, and that the community of the home is different than the community of the scientific institution or the community of the wildlife. And that, as with all other human-human relationships, our ethical duties arise out of the nature of the community, what's in the community, what it is about, what is it promoting, and what are our interests, and what are the other community member interests within it. So I think it's not inappropriate to break down where the rat is to talk about what our duty is to it. I know there's disagreement on that point. Some would say that a rat's a rat's a rat, and this duty's the same everywhere, but I think that it's just so oversimplified that it doesn't help.
Communities can be wonderful things. By definition, though, if we define ourselves as being within a community, that means somebody gets left out. So where do the boundaries end with regard to animals?
Well, with animals, it's easier in the sense that their community is pretty much their physical space. It's where are they in the world? Who is interacting with them? We as humans now have communities based on social networks with people around the world, and we've lost that physical dimension of community being the dominant way of defining a community. But with animals, it's pretty much where are they physically?
Okay, so what should we take into account when we decide either individually or collectively if there are situations in which it's appropriate for humans to use other animals?
Well, that's what a whole book's about,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think that in all circumstances, the concept of respect must be present. It's applied differently in the different communities, but the idea of acknowledging this is another being, that I have some level of obligation to these beings to be at least not harmful to them, and trying to be as supportive of them as is possible and appropriate in a human world.
You don't subscribe to what is called animal abolitionism, which is, if I understand correctly, humans have no right to use animals in any way, even as pets. You've arrived at the conclusion that use is not inherently abuse. It might be, but it's not always.
Right. And I always find it very curious that the group of people who seem most ardent to help animals have moved to a philosophical position where they want to eliminate animals. It's just a disconnect that I don't get. So I'm thinking, do I want to be in a world with more animals or less animals? And I think more animals are better than less animals. And I think that we should promote animals be wherever it makes sense to have animals, particularly in a world where humans are overrunning the earth, taking over all the land, all the habitat, extraordinary degrees of interference with wildlife. So it used to be that we coexisted with wildlife, and that's no longer the case. We're taking wildlife out everywhere. So if we don't intentionally bring animals forward, then there won't be any animals. I think, you know, when you think about cows in the field, do you think it's a good idea that we should have a future that has cows eating pasture in the field? And if you do, then we got to change a whole lot of things to make that a positive future.
And there are some animals, you know, more of them exist in the world because we use them. Now, the question of how good or bad that existence is very much up for debate. But for example, when you talk about cattle, there are more cattle because of agriculture than probably would exist within nature. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, clearly. Our domestic food system is overwhelmed any natural food system that we might have had, 4,000 years ago. So, yes, we have all this land and all this energy dedicated towards raising animals, but then we don't respect them.
Is it possible to give animals a choice about their welfare and their well-being when we don't actually understand how much they comprehend?
Yes, I think it is. What you do is you give them choices. That's exactly what you do. Their world is defined by being able to make choices as is driven by their nature. So I have no limitations on my chickens. They get up in the morning and they make choices about how they're going to spend their day, and I give them a little food at some point in the day, but they have a life full of choices.
If a chicken runs out of your yard, do you let it choose to keep going, or do you feel like it's ethical to go bring that chicken back?
Ah, well, my chickens stay in my yard because, believe it or not, chickens don't wander anywhere near as much as cats and dogs. My dogs, I feel I have an obligation to bring back because I don't think the world's safe off my land. And therefore, I do think you interfere, just like you do with your four-year-old child. You can't let your child have choices without limitations. In fact, organizing how you define what they do have a choice to do. You want them to have choices, but you can't give them unlimited choices. The animal is no different than the child.
You also ask us to consider the difference between using our children's labor in different ways. So most people agree it's okay for kids to be asked to help around the house, even in a family business or a farm. We've had to create laws, though, to regulate abusive child labor, right? So we've decided we don't want children laboring in factories all day. How can that example help us to think about animal labor? I'm thinking about, you know, dogs that are sniffing for drugs at the airport or horses that we ask to carry a rider.
Well, we already have. One of our first laws that was adopted in New York City, well, New York State of New York, but applied in New York City back in 1867, the first thing that was outlawed was the overloading and overdriving of horses. And so we've long recognized that some people will abuse that relationship just like they do with children, and therefore we need to have it. And our criminal law is specifically set out to try to draw those lines where they become abusive.
It's really hard to know sometimes the difference between something an animal can do physically and cognitively and something an animal should be made to do. So there's the question of a horse being trained to do work around a farm or to carry somebody through terrain. And then there's the question of animals that are trained, you know, that use that same horse and put it in a circus and make it do tricks.
Right. That's an ongoing social discussion. Obviously, some people think it's okay to do that. Others would disagree. We do have an important role for science here to inform us more, as much as we can. We know a whole lot more than we did 50 years ago about the nature of particular animals or species of animals anyways. And don't forget, individual animals within a species also have their own personality and their own likes and dislikes. They are not cookie-cutter creatures by any means. I've watched our sheep, and over time, there's some that are assertive, there's some that are bashful, there are some that like to have fights, there's some that want to go hide under a tree. And so they all have their own personalities even within a particular species. And we need to know that. We need to know that to give them respectful use.
How many sheep do you have?
Well, we're down to about a dozen now. We had up to 90 at one point.
So when you had too many to know them as individuals, what questions did you ask yourself? What did you expect of yourself to ensure that you were respecting them even as you used them?
Well, you can abstract up, after you know a fair number of sheep, you can abstract up and say, all right, for this group of sheep, what do we need to do? Mm-hmm. We need to monitor them for having too many worms. We need to make sure they have the right minerals, make sure they have shade and water and food, and they'll take care of themselves if you provide them with the basics of life like that.
What happens when a wolf comes nearby? Which animal's life is more important?
Well, we don't have to make that choice because I have guard dogs that keep
okay.
the wolves at bay. Well, it's more important to me that my sheep stay alive, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this is it's a question that you know, lots of people are faced with in lots of different situations.
That's true. That's true. I'm going to say that for the most part, people have the right to protect their own property, their own sheep, their own animals.
And you note that sometimes when animals are property, they are in a position to be better cared for than if they were on their own.
Oh, I think that's certainly the case, yes. But domestic animals, not wildlife. Wildlife should be left in the wild. But domestic animals, by almost definition, require some degree of aid from us, or they are not going to do very well. Cat colonies, perhaps, is an exception. But even that, I'm not sure, is certainly not the best possible life.
And, of course, some domestic animals have had their bodies and brains changed over time as we've selected and evolved them.
Yes, very much so, unfortunately.
My guest is David S. Favor. He's professor of law at Michigan State University School of Law and author of a new book called Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. If you'd like to contribute to the discussion, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink. listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with David S. Favor, professor of law at Michigan State University School of Law. His book is called Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I want to talk about a question you raise here that has really stuck with me. A lot of vegans do not use animal products of any kind because they don't believe it's ethical for humans to do so. You know that pretty much anybody who eats plants is, by definition, supporting a system that has an effect on local wildlife and ecosystems. A farm is not a natural environment. So how should we think about agriculture to be sure that we're making decisions that are consistent with our values?
Well, yes, and I think this is one of the most difficult problems that we have facing American society, and unfortunately it's being spread around the world, so more issues arising everywhere. It is the desire to have capitalist efficiency come to play to produce animals for food and eating. And it's resulted in some really extraordinary events of corn being harvested in all these fields, even next to confinement facilities that are raising cattle, where there's a disconnect between the animal and what it is, which is a herbivore that likes to go out and eat the grass, and us feeding it all sorts of things because it's economically efficient. And I think what we have to think about is, what about this monocultural agricultural system we've put in place in the United States, both as to plant crops and as to animals, too, at the same time? And I think the better way to think about things is we ought to have as a goal to bring back, if we could, the farms where there was complexity, not efficiency. And in that complexity, there's a place for all kinds of animals. And if we bring back the pasture-based system for raising herbivores, it inherently makes available a much more complex environment for the wildlife of the locality.
Of course, that also means more, potentially more wild land being used as arable land, which changes habitats.
Well, no, I think I'd like to see them give up raising some corn. I don't think we need any new farmland. Okay. I think we need to repurpose what we have.
You also raise something you call the airplane food dilemma. Explain that.
Yes. Do you want me to...
Tell us what that is.
Okay. Well, that is the result of my experiences of being on a plane back when they used to serve food. And right. I would occasionally upgrade food for free. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd be upgraded to first class because I was an almost frequent flyer. And that at that time, you didn't have a choice. They just gave everybody in first class the same food, basically. And one time there was something with ham in it. And I was sitting there thinking... I didn't ask for ham. I wouldn't eat it normally because I have no idea where it came from. But now I have the dilemma in front of me that I enjoyed previously the taste of ham. And so what is the best thing to do to honor the pig that the ham came from? To consume it and think about it or to have it put into the trash?
And I guess your choice was to eat it rather than have been slaughtered for nothing.
There's no right answer there. Mm-hmm. It's, did you think about it, really, is what I want.
Huh. All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also find us on Twitter at KERAThink. We have Brian calling from Plano. Hey, Brian.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Well, I love your guest, and this is really topical for me. We spend a lot of time, and we have a family member who's really kind of a gung-ho vegan and, you know, absolution animal rights. And so I've kind of gotten immersed in that world a little bit. And one of the things, really get your guests' input on, is how to, seems like those guys are so absolutist, they won't, you know, everything's black and white, and there's no middle ground like your guest is kind of proposing. And so I wonder if your guest has found any way to reason or to talk with folks in that kind of absolutist world there.
Thanks for your call.
Wow, that's a very good question. And I don't have any really good answers there. I think part of the problem is that so few people actually, they condemn agricultural animals, but they don't actually know any. They don't have any sense that a sheep or a pig could have a good life, that the farm doesn't necessarily have to be these horrible things that we now have of concrete and iron and steel. Of course, I reject those. But the question is there a way that you can have a farm animal that is going to become food but still have a good life? And the answer is yes, there is. But I will have to say that logic doesn't seem to enlighten the sort of that discussion, particularly new vegans who have almost a religious view of the need to have purity towards animals. And it's sort of sad. I don't have an easy answer for you. I'm sorry.
What do you think are our obligations as humans? How much do we need to explore and understand the capacity animals have for pain and suffering?
I think we know quite a bit about it already, but there's certainly always room for more. The animals we're most concerned about are mammals, and mammals have the same basic neurological structure that we have. Now, there'll be certain different kinds of responses in there, but I don't think anybody can say that we don't understand mammals feel pain in the same basic way that we do. And suffering is a lot more complex, right? Because what is suffering? What is suffering in a human? It can be all kinds of various things, and it has a psychological impact to it. And that's important to think about, because I do think we have an obligation to think about suffering from the psychological. It's not just withdrawal of food or the infliction of pain. It's, are you frustrating the animal to a point where it's actually detrimental to the animal? And that's where we see, when you go to the zoo and you see the lion pacing back and forth in endless circles or something, with the brain has been impacted. We've imposed suffering on that animal because of the conditions it's being put in. And that's something we should try to obviously avoid. So I do know that the people in the world of zoos, and to some degree those that hold the animals in scientific research facilities, are indeed right now looking into the issue of, well, what makes a good life for this particular kind of animal. So there's lots of people thinking about that right now.
For someone trying to decide whether a good life for an animal justifies that animal's slaughter and consumption later, are there some questions you think we should ask ourselves?
Well, the first question is, do we want these kinds of animals around at all? One of the hard realities of our human world is that sometimes to save an animal, you have to eat it. In other words, if you want life, you have to accept death. Death is inherently part of having brought something to life. And in my mind, the really important question is, well, what about that life? If you're responsible for bringing that animal into life, are you not responsible for the quality of its life?
And of course, nobody judges an animal that is naturally carnivorous, but humans are different because we know that we can survive on a diet that doesn't contain animal products. It takes a little extra work. On the other hand, lots of people think humans evolved to consume animal products.
Well, I really reject that last idea. So what? You know, that doesn't answer an ethical question at all. That simply is facing what we did in the past. And by the way, I don't think there's any way that we're going to be able to have my idealistic farm provide enough meat for everybody to eat as we now, at the level of meat that we eat now. There needs to be alternatives. We need to become semi-vegans. We need to have plant-based development of burgers, and other things have to come to the fore to help with this, because there isn't a way for New York City to get all the protein that it needs out of pasture-based meat, I'm afraid.
So you talked earlier about communities and that it can be helpful to start by considering the animals that sort of live in our environment. On the other hand, every time I get into my car, I'm contributing greenhouse gases to the environment that might affect animals that are thousands of miles away from me.
That's true. Well, you're impacting people, too, let alone animals.
Yeah.
That's a whole different discussion. I teach international environmental law as well, and I spend a fair amount of time with global warming issues. And it can lead a guilt trip on just about anybody for doing anything. And I don't have an answer to that. Yes, you are correct. In a minuscule way, you're doing that. And maybe you should think about driving a little bit less. But I don't think that the answer is that we all become recluses and don't do anything either.
I really like this conversation because you seem to be comfortable with the fact that there aren't always clear-cut answers to things. There are important questions to ask, and we might arrive at different conclusions. So many times, you know, so many people might tune in hoping that you're going to give us a set of guidelines and we can just follow what you say and not think about it again.
Well, that's being a law professor, where I've learned, I think, over the decades, that what's important is that people consider the questions, and answers will evolve and develop, and other things will happen. And usually they evolve in the direction I like them to do, but what I most want is, most important, is to get the questions out there.
All right, let's go back to the phones. The number 1-800-933-5372. We have Molly on the line in Dallas. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I just wanted to offer a thought that I've thought about for a long time. The whole concept of wearing fur versus fake fur, and thinking about how fake fur is manufactured mostly out of plastic materials, and how, you know, people who are, you know, subscribing to vegan ideals might find that to be controversial, but when fur is worn out, real fur, I mean, it tends to biodegrade and it returns to the earth much like a decaying animal, versus fake fur, which will just become even more small versions of plastic and contribute to this proliferation of plastic in our ecosystem. So I was hoping you might talk about the irony of it.
Thanks for your call. It sounds like Molly has thought deeply about this, David.
Yes, that's very encouraging. Thank you, Molly. My problem with fur versus fake fur is, well, it's not clear you need fur at all in today's world. But the conditions that fur animals are kept under are simply morally unacceptable. They are horrible conditions. And the fur animals have not evolved to the point of being able to live with humans. They are entirely caged, entirely controlled, totally frustrated lives. They don't care about the mind of the animals at all. They just want the fur. So regardless of alternative sources, I really am a strong advocate of not having fur, natural fur. We just need to find some alternative. Go to wool.
My guest is David S. Favor of Michigan State University School of Law. We're talking about his book, Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Okay, back to the phones now. Up next, we have Sarah calling from Grapevine. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you for writing this book, and it's very informative, and I would encourage it to be used in schools to educate kids about having respect for the world around us. My question is, my concern for the corn industry and its impact on the foods that we give the pork animals to eat, that it's not a natural thing that they eat, and it's been proven in the cattle industry that it tends to make them sick. What do you think about that in our food system for domestic pets?
Well, I think I agree with you. I think that we have set the system up to make corn the answer to everything, because the corn producers have control of the political and regulatory process, apparently. And that this is really not a good thing for the country. It's great for the corn producers, but I think I would try to move towards us not supporting the growth of so much corn, reducing that. It distorts everything else. It makes pasture, because corn is so cheap, it makes raising animals on pasture seem inappropriately from an economics point of view. If we would get rid of some of that corn, then maybe it would make more economic sense to move animals back onto pasture.
How should we make decisions about endangered species? Do we owe it to vanishing animals to actively try and reinforce their populations?
Okay, now that's a different level of question, because here we're not talking about animal welfare. Here you've now moved into the world of ecology and environmentalism, and that is, do we want to save species primarily because of the role that they play in their ecological systems, and the fact that we humans dealing with the, you know, individual wildlife don't think of themselves as species, right? That's our abstraction. I happen to agree that I think that's a good place to draw a line and say what we humans are doing is obviously not good, because we're actually driving other species into extinction. So I think respect for the species is something we can think about and deal with at a particularly high level of abstraction, and we ought to do more of that.
So what do we do when it appears that animal welfare is in direct conflict with human welfare. And maybe it's not just a life or death matter. Maybe it's a particular ecosystem being degraded by an important human economic activity like logging or oil and gas extraction.
Well, in the United States, we already made that decision. And we decided back in the 1970s that keeping the animal, the species, alive was more important than any particular economic activity, because the Endangered Species Act does not allow for you to set aside the protections of the act just because you're going to produce something that's a major economic enterprise. And we had a Supreme Court case, Hill versus TVA, in which the Supreme Court looked at the law and said, yes, you're right. You cannot use this dam on this river because it's going to take out an endangered species, and we don't care that it costs $3 million to build the dam. The law doesn't allow you to do it. So in the United States, we really have a fairly aggressive protection for endangered species that is not replicated in many other countries.
As you know, people continue to debate laws even after they have been settled by the Supreme Court. How often should we reconsider the laws that we've made, that either, to either offer more protection or remove protections?
Well, sure. That's part of a democracy, is the ongoing reconsideration of laws. And the Endangered Species Act has got a lot of attention from conservatives who perceive it as being too protectionist and interfering with economic development. And there's no answer to that politically, except that we have an open and full, robust debate, and then the ethics of the voters come into play. What do they think? You know, is this something that we want to change, or should we leave it the way it is, or do what? The Endangered Species Act has been unmodified for over 20 years because both sides are kind of scared to see what would happen if we actually opened up the door and said, let's reconsider the whole thing from the base up, and nobody really wants to put it in that risk of a position.
My guest is David S. Faber, professor of law at Michigan State University School of Law. His book is Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with David S. Faber, who's professor of law at Michigan State University and author of Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Is it okay for us to breed animals and select for particular genetic traits? Is it okay that we have deliberately made, a bulldog that is a lot different from a German Shepherd?
Well, I can get in trouble here, right? There's a lot of breeders out there. I think that we have bred for specific traits, and in the past they were work-related. In other words, it was to help the dog perform certain functions that would help for the humans, get rats out of the barn, get ducks from the water, do various other things. I think that it becomes a little less ethical in my mind when it's for something frivolous. I want it to have a pink coat rather than a blue coat or something like that. And I particularly find it unethical when the breeding results in the animal no longer being able to go through the normal birthing process. I do think there's something wrong there, where humans now have to assist with either the breeding or the birthing of a particular animal. So there's sort of a biological line I draw, but I'd also like to have a motivation test on it too.
On the other hand, the chickens that people eat have been changed over time. I mean, some of that has to do with the way that they're raised and fed, but they are genetically different than their wild ancestors. Theoretically, fewer of them have to be slaughtered to feed people because we've made them so big and fat.
Right, but the problem with that is that in doing that, we've imposed certain levels of suffering and lack of options to make life at all comfortable for the birds while they are alive. They've been bred to gain weight so fast that it's unnatural and that they are unable to function, to have full functionality. My chickens are Icelandic chickens, and they can survive in the wild. They do not put on meat like the meat chickens do. And I think that we need to pull back from that. One time we got a set of the more genetically modified chickens, and they were kind of scary. They were freaky. They didn't seem to have chicken nature to them. And after having watched Icelandics, which are pretty much a primitive breed, and it's sort of sad. They didn't know to act like a chicken when you put them out on grass. And so I think... again, this idea of efficiency being driven by the industry, how can I produce the most number of meat with the least amount of cost in the shortest period of time, that's not what should drive the animals that we share the earth with.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Joe on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Professor, good day to you.
Yeah, go right ahead, Joe, with your question.
I would like to ask, I live in Dallas now, but I used to have a cattle ranch down in the Texas Hill Country, and we ran free-range cattle, and we slaughtered a steer calf every year, and we would share that with other families for other products, eggs, things like that, and we did a lot of deer hunting, and we hardly ever bought store-bought meat. And from what I've seen in videos of the corporate meat world, that's a pretty brutal industry. So what do you think about the ethics of the way we were getting by versus somebody who's a carnivore, who lives in an urban area or something and relies solely on store-bought products?
Thanks for your call.
I'm with you 100%. I think that's the ideal. I think we need to get back to a position where that makes sense and can be done on an economic basis. That's you were in touch with the world, you're in touch with people that cared about animals, and that's where I live right now, in the rural part of Michigan. My neighbor down the street raises pigs in his backyards, and we get some of those, and somebody else I know raises some chickens, and we raise some lamb, and so everybody shares with everybody else. You end up with good pasture-based food, and it's part of rebuilding the rural community into a network of complex little enterprises called families.
Just so I understand you, are you saying that urban people who are not in a position to raise their own meat shouldn't consume it?
I think they need to think more carefully about where it comes from and put more commercial pressure on producers and support those producers who are trying to do this. There's now our options out in the food stores that come from people that are trying to do the right thing for their animals. And if people would simply be selective and be buying those rather than the nameless sort of food that comes through the other places, then that would be ideal. Whole Foods has an interesting option where they provide you with a sliding number scale for the welfare of the animal that's being produced there. And the less welfare enhancement, the cheaper the price. So you get a choice, but it's not black or white. There's like five different levels of welfare enhancement that could be provided at Whole Foods.
All right,
I'd like to see more of that.
Back to the phones at 1-800-933-5372. Amber's calling from Flower Mound. Hi, Amber.
Hi. I was just calling about his thoughts on micro livestock, like insects, as a future protein source and how that would work in his thoughts about ethical treatment of animals, whether or not they would be under the same umbrella and how that would work.
Thanks for your call.
Well, at the most abstract level, insects are animals, and I think that the idea of respect is a little bit harder to apply there, or I don't know enough about them, perhaps, to know how to do that, but it would be the same thing. If you want to raise insects, you need to be somewhat aware of who they are and what it takes to do them, and what do they want for life before they're going to be consumed.
Do you feel like there are other countries, other cultures that do a better job than we do in the United States of regularly considering these questions and making really thoughtful choices, regardless of what those choices ultimately are?
I think we're doing pretty well. I think the European Union is a little ahead of us in some of the areas, like no testing on cosmetics with full animals. Switzerland's an interesting country. They have had, I think, these issues before them, and I do think they're giving thoughtful consideration within the legal system in particular about what is the appropriate treatment for the status and treatment of animals. But a lot of the world, I recently just came back from Hong Kong at an animal law conference, and, you know, the whole of China, now one of the largest countries in the world with who knows how many animals there, has no national anti-cruelty law for their animals and don't have regulatory control over much of what we have in the United States. And so there's some countries way behind where we are.
So that's another really interesting, I think, point to take away from this book is that when we make collective decisions, we really do need to enshrine them in law. I mean, people might make individual choices for themselves, but we need in place, it sounds like you believe, some specific guarantees that animal rights will be considered.
Yes, that's correct, because we know, unfortunately, if you take 100 human beings, a few at one end of the spectrum are psychopaths and don't even care about humans, mm-hmm. let alone animals. So we need to have some criminal laws in place to give minimal levels of protection for those animals. And right now we're crafting those laws with our companion animals as a primary focal point. We do not seem to be doing that same thing for our agricultural animals at the moment. So we have a disconnect there. We have not yet brought the pig into the same arena as the dog and the cat is. But we're working on it. You know, I think things are happening. Right now, it's sort of sad in the U.S. Our legal system seems to be frozen. Nothing's happening at the federal level for anything, one way or the other. And so we've had the powers of economy now working more for the animals than the law is. But we need to get back to the law.
What does the law say these days in most places with regard to pets? If I have a dog or a cat, I consider it much more than a possession. But is it still a possession in the eyes of laws in most U.S. states?
Oh, yeah. This is another difficulty in the animal movement is how to think about this. Yes, clearly all animals are property. But at the same time, you have to put an asterisk on them and say that they are special property because they have the protection of the criminal law against cruel acts, against unnecessary pain and suffering. And there's no anti-cruelty law for pianos or chairs or cars or anything else. So we separated over 100 years ago. We separated animals from other kinds of property and gave them some levels of protection. And we seem to be increasing that. In the last 20 years, we've seen the status of dogfighting moved into basically across the whole country a revulsion and rejection of dogfighting as an appropriate use of animals. And the law keeps getting increasingly punishing for those in engage in that. So some areas we reach a consensus on, but in other areas we've not yet done that.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's speak next on the phone with Ben in Carrollton. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Hi, I had a question about just the generalization of, like, you're talking about how it's ethical to have a more humane lifestyle for the livestock and stuff versus pushing for more just a vegan lifestyle. I know it's extreme for people, for omnivores to go from omnivore to vegan, so do you think incremental steps is a better way to go, or is it better to just kind of push in general for, like, extreme change into most people, or to try to push people into being vegan?
Thanks for your call.
I'm pretty much an incrementalist. I believe the law changes incrementally, and I think diets are best changed incrementally. It's just, you know, find something you care about and think about and change one aspect of your diet so that you don't use the factory farm products anymore. And then, you know, later, if you're comfortable with that, I think you then expand that outward, or you start to look for alternatives and go out and find where the farms are and find out who's a good farmer and who's a bad farmer. So I don't think it's a good idea to tell somebody they have to just cold turkey There's an interesting saying, right? Cold turkey, all the meat they've ever eaten in their life.
We have an ongoing debate in this country about whether health care is a human right. How should we think about the right that our companion animals have to health care?
Well, the law says you do have a duty. In Michigan, it says very specifically, it's a crime not to provide veterinary care to your animal and to provide, make sure that it remains in good health. We've actually set a pretty bar for our companion animals. We say more about them than we do about our children or our mothers and fathers.
All right. Very quickly, let's go to Aaron in Tyler. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is along the lines of the veganism and vegetarianism. I've been a vegetarian for over 20 years and dabbled with veganism, so I appreciate his idea of going in slowly. But what is the role of vegetarianism and veganism in a viable option given the population of the planet?
Well, I can't solve that one in the next 2 minutes. I'm incremental. Let's move forward and think about it. I don't have a solution for everything. I think technology is going to help us in the next 20 years provide some alternatives to it. But the idea is we need to think about it and try to and move us in the right direction.
So you have chickens and sheep. I don't know if you have other animals as well. Did you grow up on a farm or did you make the conscious choice as an adult to make this part of your life?
This was when I was 50. The law school moved from downtown Detroit to East Lansing, and we realized we had the opportunity to think about something other than subdivision to live in, and we ended up with a farm. Yeah. And so it's a decision my wife and I have made fairly late in our life, after all the free labor of our children have left. And but it's been quite an interesting experience for us.
So how can the rest of us who are not going to, you know, care for animals in quite this way, build the habit of routinely questioning our assumptions about the way we use animals?
I think the first step is to recognize that you are using animals and that package of food is an animal or was an animal. And it was breathing and thinking and it was having a life. And then you should go on the internet and look it up and see, well, what kind of life did this animal have? And what do I think about that?
Has it changed your life? It sounds like you cared about animals before. Has it changed your life to have responsibility for so many of them?
I think it changed our sense of what's going on when you had responsibility for animals that were not companion animals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their point is not to sit in your lap. They don't lap. They don't come up and lick you. They don't do all those positive things that our companion animals do. And so, you know, I after a while, I looked at the sheep out in the field. I said, well, what is a good day for a sheep? And it's not what's a good day for a dog. They don't want to interact with me. They want to sit and be comfortable, be healthy, have good food, and just enjoy being a sheep.
David S. Faver is professor of law at Michigan State and author of Respecting Animals, A Balanced Approach to Our Relationship with Pets, Food, and Wildlife. David, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We had Alan Roberts on the board for us today. You can follow us on Twitter at KERAThink. Subscribe to the podcast and learn more about the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.